difficult to start a lecture on the topic of Islam, what the Jewish people should know about Islam, since a topic like that might take me until midnight, really. But I'm going to try to give this as an introductory lecture, and hopefully we can continue next Monday. Actually, to understand the Islamic religion properly, I have to quote a professor of mine who passed away many years ago, whose name was Moshe Held. And when I started my doctoral work, it was not in NYU, it was in Columbia University, and Moshe Held was teaching advanced Hebrew language. And he used to say to us that every civilization has its own worldview. Jewish people have their worldview as they see the world through their soul, and the Jewish soul has been developing since the time of Abraham Avinu. The Greek people, they see their civilization from the beginning of the Hellenistic world. And of course, the Chinese people, even though mainland China is predominantly communist, they still see their world. Their worldview has been conditioned by thousands of years of history dating back way before even the time of Confucius. And the same thing is true when you want to know about Islam. The Islamic religion has a special worldview. It's the way of the Muslim people, the way they see everyone else. And we Jewish people, we find it very, very difficult to understand how they think. Why is that? Primarily, and very simply put, we're not Muslim. And our way of thinking for thousands of years has not been conditioned by the ethos of Islam from the beginning of Islam, and has not been conditioned by the background of Islam, which is called in Arabic al-Jahiliyya. To understand a little bit about how the Muslim people view the world today, how the educated Muslim people view the world today, I have to relate to you a story that happened to me, a personal story. I don't remember the exact number of years ago, but it was about 7 or 8 years ago. As I was terminating my career as an educator for the New York City Board of Education, I was contacted by the high school division of the New York City school system, and they asked me to produce a pamphlet for high school teachers on Islam. And it was very difficult as a Jew to do that and really be objective. But when I approach a scholarly topic, I always try as hard as possible to divorce myself, my own personal feelings, from what I'm doing. And I produced this typewritten, the days before computers, this typewritten document of about 30 pages. And I was very friendly with the Egyptian ambassador to the United Nations at that time. And I asked her to look at it. And she looked at it and said it was very good. I said, do you mind if I send a copy of this to Sheikh Mohammed Tantawi in Egypt? Now, I don't know if you know the name Mohammed Tantawi. Mohammed Tantawi, for the Sunni Muslim world, especially the Sunni Arab world, is the equivalent of the Pope for the Roman Catholic world. And that particular year, I was going to Egypt. My son was very young at that time, much younger than he is now. And he's a young fellow now. And my wife was there. And he wanted to meet me. Tantawi wanted to meet me. And, of course, I couldn't go myself. I had a facilitator who took me to Al-Azhar University, which is one of the oldest universities in the world, and probably the only oldest university in the Muslim world. And you go into this medieval building that is dating from the 8th or 9th century, which looks like it's just coming from Alif al-Layla wa-Layla, from 1001 Nights. And you walk in and all you see around you are people are clad in, they all have these white robes on, and they look like the fundamentalist view. what you imagine the fundamentalist Muslim to look like. Well, I was interviewed by the equivalent of the Secret Service for quite a while. And after this lengthy interview, the person who was interviewing says to the Farash, the Farash is like the servant, he says, "Hati Lushay, bring him some tea. So the facilitator, who was an Egyptian Arab, said to me, "You got it made." So they bring me tea, and they said, "You'll come now to meet Sheikh Tantawi." And the room I was in looked like a room out of a movie Casablanca, with this fan moving very, very slowly, you know, and warm, hot, humid day in August in Cairo. It's unbelievably hot. You have no idea what heat is until you've been in Cairo in August, because they use leaded gasoline, and the smell is in the air at all times. And I come into this room, which is about this size, air-conditioned, freezing like an icebox, and the shelves are filled with books. And as some of my former students who are sitting here know, I love books. And I'm looking at the books, and of course, Sheikh Tantawi is sitting there. He's an older man, look rather old, with a long white beard, wearing a turban. And there was a translator whose name was Sheikh Nu'aymah. In case I wanted to, needed someone to speak Arabic for me, the Sheikh and I communicated in Arabic, and he says to me, "Do you have any questions?" And I asked him about some of the books he wrote. I figured I can't jump into the more difficult question right at the beginning. And after we exchanged some information about some of the books he wrote, in fact, I wanted a copy of his doctoral dissertation, which was in print, and the name of his doctoral dissertation was Banu Israel fi al-Qur'an wa al-Sunnah, the children of Israel in the Qur'an and in Muslim tradition. It's a massive tome for about 800 pages of very uncomplimentary material about us. In any case, Sara Sheikh, Andi Su'al Makhsus, I have a special question. He says, "Sal, ask." So I said to him, "What do you really know about the Jewish people?" And as some of you who have attended some of my other lectures may remember, he said to me, "Alladhi maktub fi al-Qur'an kifayya." What is written in the Qur'an is enough. So I said to him, "Isn't that being rather unfair to a people whose history extends 5,000 years?" And he wouldn't answer that question. And the other sheikh, Nu'aymah, escorted me out of the room, and that was the end of the interview. And this is one man out of 1,300,000,000 Muslims in the world. I'm going to say that number again. 1,300,000,000 Muslims in the world. It's a figure that we can't even begin to comprehend. And the reason we really can't comprehend it, and I can't really comprehend it, in terms of numbers, is because in the year 610, which was 1400 years ago, there was one Muslim in the world who lived nowhere, and that was Muhammad. He lived nowhere. He lived in a desert. Nowhere. Because the civilizations at that time were surrounding him, the periphery of the Arabian Peninsula. And this Islamic civilization has grown to be a power which we in the West have scarcely begun to comprehend. We've scarcely begun to comprehend the power and awesomeness of this civilization. And when does this all begin? Well, we know it begins with the Arabs. And just who were the Arabs? We want to know that. Well, legend would have it that the Arabs come from Ishmael. We all know that Abraham Avinu had two sons, one Yitzhak, one Ishmael, and there are stories that have developed and accrued. Post-biblical material has said that we go through Yitzhak, And the Arabs, they come from Ishmael. We look at archaeology, which we do, we see that the earliest mention of the Arab people in history is approximately in the 8th century BCE, and they're mentioned in the inscriptions in the Assyrian annals. Remember, there were two mighty civilizations in Mesopotamia. You have the Bavlin, Bavel, as in the Nebuchadnezzar, and we have the Ashurim, Ashur. So Ashur was to the south. If you know the Ark, the Keshet Aporiyah, Ashur was to the south and Bavel was to the north. Well, vice versa, I believe. Ashur was to the north and Bavel was to the south. And we have here the idea that the Arabs are mentioned north of where they are today as a nomadic people. But no writing. The Arabs are not writing in the 8th, 7th, 6th, 5th, 4th centuries BCE at all. They have not got their own written language. What about the Arabs that we have today? Are they the same as the Arabs mentioned in the Assyrian annals? Well, that's something we really can prove, because the word Arab itself means many things. One thing it means is someone who lives in the Arava. The Arava is the desert. Another meaning of the word Arab is someone who speaks the Arabic language flawlessly, without error. Someone who speaks the classical Arabic language. We probably know that, just to mention briefly, that there are actually two types of Arabic languages. One is the written Arabic, which is standardized throughout the entire Arab world. So from Morocco in the west, all the way across to the Gulf states, through Iraq, the Arabic language is standardized in all literature, in all newspapers. The grammar is one, but in all the Arabic countries, the Arabic language is different. So the Yemenite will speak one dialect of Arabic, the Moroccans will speak a different dialect of Arabic, the Algerians will speak a different dialect of Arabic, the Syrians, the Egyptians, the Sudanese, and sometimes they're mutually unintelligible. But what unifies them is the Nahawi, or the standardized, grammatically correct Arabic, the written Arabic. So an educated Arab from Maghreb, from Morocco, could speak to an educated Arab from Libya, from Egypt, from Syria, from Sudan, without any difficulty if they're speaking the written language. You could stop me anytime, by the way, just if you have a question, because I tend to throw out a lot of facts. Just put your hand up and ask. Don't be bashful. I like to answer questions. Yes?
Then the term Arab wasn't around, but the Assyrians were, the archaeologists saw that they referenced to a people in the north. What was the reference, or how do we...
That's the word Urbi. Mm-hmm. Urbi is the term that's used in the Assyrian inscriptions, and it would refer to a nomadic people. People who are on camel. Pure nomad, because in the ancient world, there are two types of nomadic people. There's the desert nomad, who's going to spend most of his time on a camel, and there's the donkey. The donkey is semi-nomadic, because the donkey rider, the donkey will die in a desert. It hasn't got the hoof to go in a real desert, nor does it have the eye patch, like a camel has to go in a desert, to keep out the dust. So the Urbi is the person who is the genuine nomad, the Bedouin of today. Okay. When we arrive on firmer footing in terms of the history of the Arabs, we come to a period of time which is called in Arabic Al-Jahiliyya. Al-Jahiliyya, I'll write this term down. Al-Jahiliyya, in Arabic, a history of the Arab world, refers to the period of time before the rise of Islam. It comes from the term Jahil, Jahil is a period of ignorance. And during this period, the Jahiliyyah period, we find that the Arab world, which is centered in the Arabian Peninsula today, if you can try to imagine the Arabian Peninsula without the oil wells, if you could try to imagine the Arabian Peninsula without American troops there, if you could try to imagine the Arabian Peninsula without the Saudi family, is an area that's practically empty of any human inhabitants, except for nomadic people and small oasis cities, which are primarily along the Red Sea coast. One city, was called Yathrib. Let me see if I can fix this. Okay. I'll try to write it again. Yathrib, and this city is mentioned in the, I believe, in the Babylonian annals, Yattaribu or Yattiribu. And the other city is Mecca, actually. Mecca, popularly known as Mecca, but the original pronunciation, the real pronunciation of the city is Mecca. So these are your two major cities, this one especially, and they're on the western portion of the Arabian Peninsula, not far from the Red Sea. Mecca in particular has great significance during the Jahiliyyah period. For three reasons. The first reason is on the trade route. So it's on this trade route, this caravan route, which is going from the south, from Yemen, along the coast into Palestine, not meant in a political sense, into Syria. Bilad Hashem. The second reason of the importance of Mecca was something called the Kaaba. And the Kaaba was a cube-shaped stone, which was a meteorite. And the Kaaba was a site of religious worship of the pre-Islamic Arab people. There were approximately 300 idols of different gods that were found, according to the Arabic sources, in the Kaaba. The third reason of the importance is something called the fair at Ukaz. And Ukaz was outside of Mecca. Ukaz was a fair that was held annually where the more famous poets of the Jahiliyyah would come to recite their poems. Usually they would contest each other in terms of vocabulary and in terms of rare grammatical forms. And the choice poems were usually hung along along the tent. It was called Mu'allaqat. And those are the suspended poems. Mu'allaqa means to suspend. And the Mu'allaqat were these poems that were supposedly written in gold. And they were, according to the legend, the most difficult poems that were composed in the pre-Islamic period, during the Jahiliyyah period. And these poems, when you study Arabic, usually after 3-4 years of studying the Arabic language, you get to a point where you can begin to understand the difficulty of the nuances of these poems. They're unbelievably difficult in the vocabulary and in the grammar.
Were these written in Assyrian?
No, this is written in Arabic characters.
What year would this be?
You're asking me a loaded question. I'll give you an answer that wouldn't please anyone in the Muslim world, but will please people who are interested in something, an objective fact. The question is, did the Arabs have their script? Now, some researchers would say that the Arabs used a Nabataean script originally to write their language. The Nabataeans were an Arab people who spoke Aramaic. And there is a scholar who is working in Germany now. His name is, he goes under a pen name named Luxembourg. No one that I know of knows his real name because the man fears for his life. He maintains that the Quran was written originally in Aramaic. Maybe not the entire Quran, but parts of the Quran. And a substantial part of the Quran, he maintains, comes from Christian liturgy, translated directly from Aramaic. But this is something for a later lecture to get into. The point is, assuming that the Arabs wrote in Arabic script, assuming they did, the script was unpointed, which means that there were no vowels. The earliest Arabic manuscripts of Quran are written without vowels. And that makes for some difficulty because we don't know how the letter was pointed. There are early sheets of the Quran where you don't differentiate between Dod and Sod. The Dod is not there. The diacritical mark is not there. So it was at a much later date that the points, like the Shin and Sin, at a much later date that the pointing was put into the Quran. There are people who are, I'm just going to digress for a minute to show you how interesting and somewhat difficult this whole topic becomes. There are scholars who maintain, I mean reputable scholars who maintain, that a literary analysis of the Quran proves without a doubt to a certain number of scholars, at least, that the Quran was written at least 150 years after Muhammad died. And he had nothing to do with the writing of the Quran. It was transmitted at a much later date for certain schools, much like Mishnah was a Palestinian Talmud and a Babli Talmud, a certain schools that formed this Quran.
Isn't it known that he's illiterate, though? How could they say that he wrote it? Well,
Nabi Ummi, that's the usual term they use for an illiterate, for him. What the term Nabi Ummi means, I really can't tell you. The traditional Muslim interpretation is he is an illiterate person. But Ummi could be a person who was for the Ummah.
Right.
The Ummah being the community, the Muslim community. The greatest difficulty in understanding, let me just build a little bit on this and I'll take your question. The greatest difficulty in coming up with objectivity in the study of Islam, and I think all Jews concerned Jews should know this, is that all your material is totally subjective. It's all Arabic sources. There's nothing that's from the outside. So we're dealing with what they say about themselves rather than what others say about them. Now, there is material, what others say about them, but it's first being looked at now. There was a scholar who passed away in Israel some years ago. His last name was Nevo. And he took, he wrote a book where he analyzed all the early Arabic rock inscriptions. And he found in these rock inscriptions many of the so-called formulas that are used to describe Allah in the Quran are never used in these rock inscriptions, and the rock inscriptions date to the first year of Islam, which would mean, linguistically speaking, that the Quran post-dates these rock inscriptions. Question. There are pages that exist. There was a page that was found some years ago, I'm talking about in the 1970s, I think in the Topkapi Museum in Turkey, and it had variant readings of some of the surah.
They have the
Imota Kriya
and
Hebrew
Alif
Bab
used.
The
Imota
Kriya?
Yeah, they have the Imota Kriya or they don't have
no.
At that stage?
No. No, there are certain letters that are not there. They are written but not pronounced, but they are very, very rare in the Arabic language. Like you say, Katabu,
yeah.
They wrote the Aleph, you don't pronounce it, but we don't know why it's there.
Yeah, three vowels.
Right, only three vowels.
Only three vowels.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Just when you were talking about the Kaaba, the 300 idols, did I understand you that you said that they were found inside of it or around
it? It was supposed to be around it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and in fact, the Shia have a legend. You know, in the Muslim world, there are two basic groups. There's the Sunni, which is the larger group, and they constitute probably 90% of the Muslim world, or close to it. And the Shia, who are primarily in Iraq, they're the larger group in Iraq, at least not politically. They weren't politically active under Saddam's rule, but they're the larger group numerically. They're a very large minority in Lebanon, and they're the predominant group in Iran. So the Shia, they have a legend that Ali, who was the son-in-law of Muhammad, was born. He was born near the Kaaba. That's they want to make the Kaaba very holy, even before Islam, even before the religion was revealed. Now, moving a little bit back to our study. Go ahead.
Maybe I missed this point, but were the Jews the original scribes of the Quran?
Well, you know, there are stories that circulate in the community, right? And one of the famous stories is that there's Alif Lam Mim, and there's also Taha. These are so-called they're mystery letters in some of the surah or chapters of the Quran. And the Alif Lam Mim in particular, there's a story that circulates among many Egyptian Jews that this was written by, the Quran was written by an Egyptian Jew, and he put down the Ani Lo Ma'amin, Alif Lam Mim. Now, I mean, there may be, there is some indication. There was a very great scholar, Jewish scholar, whose last name was Margoliath. And he was rather prolific. I think he was an English scholar who wrote quite voluminously about Islam at the turn of the 20th century. And I believe in one of his books, if I remember correctly, he says, and he gives the citation, that after the Quran was made the official book of the Arabic peoples and used in their madrasa, in their schools, being that many of the Arabs were illiterate, they had to have Jews teach it. Now, maybe there's a kishir between what Margoliath says and what circulates in the Kehillah. You know, when the smoke is fire. There may be some truth to it, but nothing that's firm. We want to point out something very, very important in terms of history. What I'm pointing out to you now is something that if this were a Muslim, the Hadir, a Muslim lecture, wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be talking about this.
Critically.
To understand objectively how our religion developed. In terms of the Muslim understanding, it's the Word of God, pure and simple. And we don't question. Not to say that there aren't Muslims. There is a website. You have to hunt for it on the internet. It's Muslims for a Secular Islam. Something like that. It's a website that appears and disappears. Depends who's trying to shut it down. But there is a website of concerned Muslims who want to get the world, or at least the Western world, to have a different picture of Islam. But the critical understanding of Islam began in the early 19th century thanks to two Jews, both living in Central Europe. One was a man named Solomon Geiger. And those of you who may have taken a course in Jewish history may remember that Solomon Geiger was one of the founders of the Reformed Jewish movement in Germany. Solomon Geiger wrote a dissertation in Latin. In those days, if you wrote a dissertation for your PhD in a German or a Viennese university or Austrian university, you wrote your dissertation in Latin. And his dissertation was to be translated into English. If you were translated, it was Judaism and Islam. And what he did was he subjected the Quran and the Islamic and the traditions, the hadith, the collections of sayings attributed to Muhammad, to a scientific analysis to try to show the source material for his words. And when you read this book, you see that his conclusions are that there's really very, very little original in the Quran, and much of it is coming from a corrupted form of Judaism. The second scholar who worked on this topic was a man named Ignaz Goldziher. And Ignaz Goldziher was originally, he was a Hungarian rabbi, and his original forte, his original field was biblical studies. And because he was discouraged by some of his professors to go into biblical studies, he went into Islamic studies instead. And he wrote two massive tomes, volumes, which are usually translated, and they're called Islamic Studies, or Mohammedan Studies, longly. It's the wrong term, of course. It should be Islamic Studies. And what he does, he tries also to show the sources for your Quranic basis. And he tries to show that the source material in the Quran, complementing now Geiger, and complementing a third scholar named Theodor Nordicke, who was a German scholar who lived at the same time, that the source material in the Quran is four. There's four basic source materials going into the Quran. The first is Jewish. Preponderance of Jewish material in the Quran, which we'll get into next week, inshallah. Second is Christian. And in fact, Jesus is accepted as a prophet, you know, by Muslims, not as Son of God or any one of the triune God, but they say that the crucifixion never occurred. It was a Jewish law. In the Quran it says that. The third source of Quranic material would be Zoroastrianism, which was the native religion of the Persian people. And the fourth source would be the accretions that came from the Jahiliya period, the Arab mind that went into the Quran. And the Arab mind, just to point out two ideas which make their way from the Jahiliya period into the Quran in various ways. One is a concept which is called Sa'ar. Sa'ar means, would be the equivalent of a Go'el Haddam. So if someone has killed someone from your family, it's your duty to pursue that person and wreak vengeance on the other individual. The other idea is something called Ajal. And in the Jahiliya period, Ajal means fate. So people will, you can't turn aside what God has foreordained for you. So, for example, if a person is on a camel, this is the Jahiliya period, person is riding in a camel caravan and tumbles and falls down for whatever reason, for thirst, or it collapses because of the heat, it's the person's ajal that person should die, and you can't assist that person. So you have in the Arab ethos, in their way of thinking, that whatever Allah has foreordained, Allah, one of the descriptive terms for Allah is Al-Qadir. Al-Qadir, the determiner. God determines, Allah determines for you your destiny. I think the Turks use the term kismet. That this is how it is, and you can't turn it aside. So you have many, many elements, we have to understand this, that are going into what we call Islam. Now, of course, if I were a Muslim, you wouldn't think that way. Let me just clarify one point. For a Muslim, the language of the Quran, for example, is the pure Arabic. There are no foreign words in the Quran. But if you look at a Quranic dictionary, which is not produced by a Muslim, and the most famous one is one produced by John Penrice, or a man named Jeffries, you'll find there are dozens of loan words in the Quran. There's one famous phrase in the Ayat al-Kursi, is the Ayah is like a pasuk. Ayat al-Kursi is the verse of the throne where Allah is called Al-Hayyu wa'al-Qayyumu. Al-Hayyu wa'al-Qayyumu. Well, we know Hay b'Kayyam. Here you have an exact quotation from Baruch Sha'amar. Hay b'Kayyam. And Qayyum, even when you look at the grammar books, the classic Arab grammar books in the Middle Ages, the form Qayyum is unknown in the Arabic language. So the great Persian grammarian Sibawahi, he questions this form as to where it came from. And even in the first surah of Quran, the first chapter of Quran, you have a phrase that God should guide us along, al-sirat al-mustaqim. Sirat al-mustaqim is the straight path, like al-dinah al-yishara. Sirat is a Latin word, it's from strata. Strata is a path. So you find that in the Quran there are streams which are pouring in from all sides. You know, and assuming we accept the fact, for argument's sake, that Muhammad was the recipient of this information through a human conduit, not from the angel Gabriel, as the Islamic world would maintain, then therefore he had an amazing memory, because everything was filtered through his head. Wherever he went, he was gathering material from all sides. He was an amazing collector. If we assume that Muhammad was the one who did this, and it was not produced at a later date, following accretion after accretion after accretion. Question.
If I'm a Wahhabi sitting down and listening to this right now, I mean, apart from the fact
I wouldn't be here if you were a Wahhabi.
Yeah, apart from the fact that my blood would be boiling, I would be saying that this was the equivalent of a Bikoret HaMikra. And the question is whether or not, is there also a Bikoret HaBikoret? Is there a reaction to this by the Islamic scholars?
There is a reaction. But not the Islamic scholars in the Islamic world, the Islamic scholars in the United States. Because as far as there is a website which is called al-manbar.net. Now there's al-minbar.com, which is the English. And there everything is powdered with sugar and cinnamon. But on minbar.net, you get the sermons every Monday. You get the sermons from Mecca, from Medina, and Al-Quds. And you can also get the sermons from most of the larger mosques in the Muslim world, not only the Arab world. The sermons that are delivered in Arabic. And when you read it, and then you hear some of our politicians saying Islam is a religion of peace. Now, Rabbi Hidri happened to call me the other day, just to confirm tonight, and I was listening to a sermon on the internet, listening to it. It was direct from Saudi Arabia. A young sheikh, he looked like about 25, 30 years of age, and he was speaking about how it's our duty to kill the Jews and the Christians. Now, when you see this, it's one thing to read it and say perhaps, well, it's mistaken. But when you hear it, and the room is filled with supposed Saudi intellectuals, and you wonder to yourself, where are the those who question that maybe it's wrong to do this in the Muslim world? Well, if anyone would say it's wrong to do this, They might say it to themselves, but they're not going to say it verbally. Yes?
Well, my question was, was there a recognition of the criticism sufficient to generate a reaction to it within the Orthodox Muslim world?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, if I were speaking as a Muslim and I were criticizing Islam the way I'm objectively examining it, I'll correct myself. The way I'm objectively examining it now, number one, it would never occur in a Muslim university. It might occur in an American university, and if it did occur in an American university, it would provoke a heated argument from Muslim onlookers.
But let me try to explain. The Bikoret HaMikran in Judaism was the critical writing on the Tanakh, which came out possibly in the 18th and 19th centuries, predominantly in the 19th century.
Bellhausen.
So, yes.
I know that.
That subsequently generated within the Orthodox community or the Masoretic community a Bikoret HaBikoret.
I know, yeah, I know. Hoffman, Rayonot, Machriot, Negin, Bellhausen.
Yeah, Doren Moshelot, and things like that, but... my question to you is, was there that manifestation also within the
without a doubt
Islamic culture?
Yes, because as I mentioned to you, there are two major groups in Islam, Shia and Sunni, but there's a group within the Shia called the Ghulat are extremists. They believe that Ali, Ibn Abi Talib, who is the cousin of Muhammad, that he is greater than Muhammad, and there's a group within them that believe he is God. So you have a reaction against a reaction against a reaction. And of course, the Druze who fight for Israel, they're also a breakaway sect within Islam. You know, their sacred books are not examined, but we do know they broke away probably in the 8th or 9th century. So you have a decoded and another decoded. One step, and you know, there's always one group who is dissatisfied.
But did anybody react to the authors that you discussed in their works in the 19th century?
Anything on that scale?
Yes, the Arab world.
Not in the Muslim world. In the Christian scholarship, John Waynesboro, Michael Cook, Patricia Crone, they have a very famous book which you can't buy for less than $150, or approximately $150. It's called Hagarism. And Hagarism maintains that Islam started as a Jewish sect. And interestingly enough, the book is available online in Arabic. It's available in Arabic online. Yes?
So in other words, the Muslim world's reaction to these critics in those times is similar to that Sheikh's reaction to you when he basically pushed you out and shut the door. They just don't react to it. They don't answer. They don't acknowledge it.
Well, because I'll explain it to you very simply. Let me just draw this very simple diagram. Let me draw this very simple diagram, and I think this will do a lot for us.
Thank you.
This is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The Muslims, in their worldview, remember we spoke about that at the beginning, in their worldview, they believe that Judaism is a religion from God. But they believe that this religion is not the complete revelation. that we are munharif. Munharif means we have departed from the path. We have somehow perverted the message that God has given us. And they believe that Christianity is also a religion from God, but they are also munharif. They are departed from the true path. In other words, if you have this sirat al-mustaqim, this straight path, we have chosen to divert from that path. And Islam has superseded Judaism and has superseded Christianity and has become the only religion which has the complete revelation from Allah. That they have gone back. That this is not a new religion. Islam is not a new religion. Even though it's the youngest of the Islamic, of the monotheistic religions, by our calculation, by Western calculation. But they say that they have gone back to the Millet Ibrahim. Millet Ibrahim is the word of Abraham. It's very difficult to translate that into English. To the religion of Abraham, the original religion that was given to Abraham. Because they say that Abraham was the first monotheist, not the first Hebrew. They divest us, they divest our religion of any originality. Like you said, they pushed me out of the door. We have no claim to any originality in the history of religion. Because our religion, our understanding of God, is wrong. The Christians, they have divested themselves of any originality because they are wrong. And only the Muslim world is right. And they have gone back to the original source, the original revelation given to Ibrahim. And Muhammad was vouchsafed that restoration. So the original revelation of Abraham goes to him. That's why they have the Keshir through Ismail, through Yishmael, back to Muhammad. And when you read it's a very, very important volume. It's called in Arabic Sirat Rasul Allah, which is the life of Muhammad. It was written about 250 years or 200 years after Muhammad died by a man named Ibn Ishaq. And it starts off with this genealogy, like in the New Testament, in the book of Luke. You have this genealogy which tries to relate Jesus to Abraham through David. And you have the same thing with Muhammad. They take him and they send him all the way back and they try to tie him together with Ishmael and with Abraham to say that he is a linchpin that brings everything together and brings back that true religion. So, what you're doing is, as they did in medieval Islamic theology, they divide the world into two halves. On one side you have Dar al-Islam, is the world of Islam, and then the other half is Dar al-Harb, is the world of war. Now, it means that there can never be peace. Never salam, only sulh. No belligerency or hudna, a truce. You can have this type of non-belligerency, but never a complete peace between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world. That there's this constant state of tension between these people, between these two halves of the world. You see, unfortunately, I'll just make a semi-political statement those people who make the decisions what to do, how to do it, which countries to be friendly with, which countries to have better relations with, unfortunately, the problems in the Middle East, as I see it, could have really been solved a long time ago. This is really the end of a 5-lecture series. A statement I would make at the very end And I would say that if England and France and Germany and Italy and Spain and Russia and the United States and Canada, any of the other Western nations who were there, who voted for the partition of Palestine in 1947, if they said to the Arabs, look guys, you had your chance, you missed it, too bad, you're not getting a country. Let the Arab world absorb you. That would solve the problem. Because as I've tried to show you as a prelude to understanding Islam, it's a very, very complex topic. And let me just finish my one statement. It's a very complex topic. It's a very complex religion. The Muslim world, in a sense, is at war with itself. The Muslim world can't develop its own idea of what theology is or isn't. But there is an element in the Muslim world right now, a very, very troubled element, a very disturbed element. And this element in the Muslim world views itself as riding the crest of a giant tidal wave. And it had nothing to do with the tsunami from last week, by the way. They view themselves as riding a giant tidal wave that is destined to sweep over the entire world. And no matter how many times George Bush says Islam is a religion of peace, I think he knows in his heart of hearts it's not a religion of peace. And if you read between the lines the statements of Mahmoud Abbas, peace is not around the corner between Israel and the Palestinians. There's a long way to go. A long way to go, if ever. Yes?
Getting back to the separation of Islam and war. Christianity you can understand because they believe that Jesus was the God or the Son of God. So you can understand the world's not accepting of that as a complete slap in the face of their religion. However, with Islam, Muhammad was a prophet, so how are they so adamantly against other monotheistic religions, such as, let's say, Judaism, even worse than Christianity, because some people look at that as divine worship to a certain degree.
Right.
Why are you, if you're not for Islam, you should die?
I'll answer your question very simply, because the Muslim world today has politicized a situation which existed 1400 years ago and applied an economic, religious, and political rivalry which the Jews in Yathrib, Medina, experienced and projected that upon the world situation today. So if you follow my reasoning, what happened between Muhammad and the Jews of Medina 1400 years ago in round numbers really has nothing to do with the world today. But what has happened is that being that Israel and the Jewish people have risen from the ashes in spite of the fact of all the obstacles in their path and the Arab world, especially the young people in the Arab world, the intellectuals are frustrated because they can't achieve what they want to achieve. What they do is they turn inwards towards a puritanical view of their religion, and they come to the conclusion that we are the sinners and we are the wrongdoers and we don't deserve what we have and we should be removed. And they are the pure people. They are the Puritans. And being that they are the Puritans, they deserve what we have, if not more. So it's rather sociological, and it's rather political and economic, rather than religious. But they project their sociological and economic frustrations onto religion. And therefore, we become the universal pariah, and we are the ones who have to be removed. So you had broadcast, I think a week or two ago, on the Syrian TV, you had a series which was provided by Iran You can see these. If you go to the right websites, they're there. But you know the scenes they show. They show one scene where a Christian child is being bled to get matzah, blood for matzah. Another scene where a Jew is being executed. They pour lead down his throat, and they show this how cruel the Jewish people are. And there are scenes of Jews in the Rothschild family planning to take over the world. You know, when you have these kind of ideas, it has nothing to do with religion. It's frustration. It's a hatred that borders on economic and political frustration. Because if you're truly religious, I have an occasion to ask a sheikh, a rather learned sheikh, in the confines of his office. I asked him, is there anything in the Quran which negates the existence of the state of Israel? He looked at me and he said, whatever Allah has brought about, He has brought about. Nothing can be done to turn it away. But he wouldn't say that publicly. He said it to me privately. Any questions? Go ahead.
The disturbing thing to me is the question of authorship. When you look at the Quran, I just went very rapidly through it. I found the name Muhammad to be one. Is there any connection to that?
Yeah, because Muhammad is not the author of the Quran. God is.
But he received it from God.
Right. No, he didn't receive it. He got it from Gabriel. Jibril. He is the conduit. He is the messenger. He only speaks what is given to him. And even in Islamic tradition, the only prophet who heard God's voice directly was Musa. He's called Kalam Allah, which means the speech of God goes right into Musa's ear without any angel intermediary. Yes.
Does it mention anything about Jerusalem as a
Quran? Can you leave that for next week? Mm-hmm. Only because. I don't want to go ahead. The word Jerusalem is not mentioned. The word Jerusalem is not mentioned. And the whole idea of the Eretz HaKadoshah, Al-Ard Al-Muqaddasah, which is the equivalent of Eretz HaKadoshah, you know that? And even when this was written, Be it written at the time, shortly after Muhammad's death, the period of the third caliph, or even 100 years or 200 years later, it would probably mean the Arabian Peninsula. Would have nothing to do with the land of Israel. Even the whole idea of Muhammad going from Medina to Quds is a later midrash. It's not found. It's only mentioned in Quran. But doesn't mention from where he went. It says Al-Aqsa. Al-Aqsa is the furthest point. Doesn't mean Jerusalem. And this whole Midrash was developed in the 8th or 9th century by the Assyrian caliphs who wanted to make the Bilad al-Sham more important than Baghdad, than the Mesopotamian area. So you had that rivalry among the intellectuals between the Mesopotamian Islamic group and the rather Western Islamic group. And they developed the hadith that Muhammad went from the Arabian Peninsula with his horse and he went to Jerusalem. We'll take one more question. Yes?
You touched on it before, but how did Moses, Moses and his revelation and also the later prophets?
Okay, Moses is mentioned many, many times in the Quran. Noah is mentioned in the Quran. Yunus is Yonah. There is mention of course, Ibrahim, Ishaq, Yaqub. There's no mention of any of the other sons, to my knowledge, of Yaqub, Yusuf. There's a whole surah. Is the only actual story in Quran, story that follows a storyline, is Surat Yusuf, the surah, the chapter of Yusuf. Otherwise, we'll speak next week about the structure of the Quran, how it's put together. It's really a very difficult book to read in English, or in Arabic, but especially in English. Just one or two more questions.
Is it possible that part of the Quran was written by an author other than Muhammad?
Well, you weren't here at the beginning. There are scholars who believe, first of all, by Islamic tradition, Muhammad never wrote anything. He was illiterate. There are scholars who believe that the part of the Quran, if not the entire Quran itself, was written perhaps 150 to 200 years after Muhammad died. But that's a very, very few scholars.
But is it, I'm not saying, is it possible, do they claim that it was written by different authors?
Well, there is a scholar, no. The Muslim world? Oh, no. No. They say that once the Quran is the final revelation from God to humanity, nothing comes after that. Muhammad is Khatim al-Anbiya, which means the seal of prophecy. No prophets come after Muhammad.
But sometimes in some parts of some parts of it speaks somewhat kindly of Mary,
Jews.
The Surah of Mary.
Of course.
This one or that one.
Because
then it comes again and says, well, they were...
The Quran, the way the Quran is assembled, is not assembled in chronological order.
Okay.
It's assembled in order of length. The longest chapter at the beginning, the shortest chapter at the end. So, except for the opening chapter, which is called Suratu al-Fatihati, the chapter of the Fatiha, the opening chapter, which is a prayer. Then you have Suratu al-Baqarati, the chapter of the cow, which has a theme of the Para Aduma for a while. And then you have the Surah of Amran, whom they say is the father of Jesus. And then they have Al-Ma'idah, the table, and you go down and down, but it's by length. So when people memorize the Quran, and they start when they're 4 or 5 years of age to memorize it in the madrasa, they start with the shorter chapters. One of the high schools I was in many years ago, I had a boy in my class, Adam Ali. He could rattle off the surahs right and left, but didn't know what anything meant. He could just say them. But didn't know what anything meant. Nothing. But he memorized it from the time he was 4 or 5 years of age.
How would the Muslim world view, the religious Muslim world view, in the Ottoman, during the Ottomans, as opposed to now, after Abdul Wahab?
The Ottoman Empire or Ataturk?
Who was in charge, of the religion? Was it Al-Azhar in Cairo, or was it still in Saudi Arabia?
Well, technically it was in Saudi Arabia. Technically.
And their view? Of
their view was very rigid.
Before Abdullah.
And in fact, no, even after, in fact, when World War I erupted, the Sultan, whose name escapes me, who was at that time in charge in what was called the Ottoman Empire, he wanted a jihad. He wanted all the Muslim world to rise up against the infidel. Of course, no one did. But you see that, you saw that rigidity.
But they weren't more moderate?
There was. There's a scholar named Bernard Lewis. You may be familiar with his name. And Bernard Lewis is the specialist on the Ottoman Empire. And he shows how the Ottoman Empire underwent a minor renaissance and a modernization, because they invited in many, many specialists to bring mechanization to the Ottoman Empire, to modernize their armed forces and to modernize their schools. You had the Alliance Francaise, so Jewish people who lived, the Sephardim who lived in the Turkish Empire, they learned in the Jewish school, they learned the French culture. French language, or the Spanish language. The same way in Egypt. Many of the Jewish people in Egypt, they wouldn't go to public schools. They went to the private schools, Italian schools, German schools, English schools, French schools. So even in Egypt, you had a modernization, where if you go to Cairo University, is a very famous statue outside of Cairo University showing the Egyptian woman taking off her veil. But in fact, when you go to Cairo today, you'll find most women are putting back the veil when you walk in the classrooms. In the classrooms in Cairo University, even in the classrooms of the most Western disciplines, with the Western history, English, French history, American history, or the English department, you look at the girls are separate from the boys, and you find that more often than not, the women have their hair covered, and many times the professors will accommodate the students and they'll stop the class for prayer. So even in Egypt, which is among the most Western of the Arab and Islamic countries, there is a tendency to turn towards tradition, whereas under Nasser, the Ikhwan al-Muslimin were jailed and killed right and left. In fact, one of the founders of the Ikhwan al-Muslimin was Hassan al-Banna. Hassan al-Banna and Sayyid Qutb, they were put to death during the Nasser period. So, but now, of course, Mubarak is walking that very fine line, that tightrope. You know, he wants to stay in power, and he wants, I guess, his son to take his place. So he has to somehow balance and make the West happy, and at the same time he has to make the Muslim world happy. So he's trying to balance one against the other.
And that's the Saudi double-edged sword. That's what keeps them in power, and that's what's going to throw them out of power.
Well, Osama bin Laden wants to do, to throw them out of power.
Are there commentaries and interpretations on the Quran?
100%. You can in English?
No.
Yes.
There are interpretations that people follow. I mean, Saudi is following Wahhabism right now, but
yeah.
Are there different understandings of the Quran?
Yes. They range from the most popular one is the interpretation is called Jalilain. There's two brothers named Jalilain. It's like a dual ending, and there are interpretations that are 50 volumes, like the Qurtubi interpretation. Tafsir Qurtubi is massive interpretation of Quran, and it goes on and on and on forever. Like one volume, maybe only for one surah, for one chapter. And they bring in there are great scholars in the Islamic world. The most difficult, there are two great traditional. It's called Tafsir. There are two great traditional Tafsir. One is the one by Zamakhshari. Zamakhshari is a Persian. He wrote in Arabic. And you have a Tafsir on the Tafsir on the Tafsir. Because he's so difficult to understand. And then the other one, which is also a very great interpretation, is by Baydawi. Baydawi is also a very great interpretation of Quran. In fact, his interpretation of Surah Yusuf is used by most professors when you study Tafsir in like NYU or Columbia. They will use the one that's put out by Oxford University. His Tafsir on Surah Yusuf. Okay, I have to stop now. I'm tired. Okay, inshallah, I'll see you next week. And we'll continue from there.